I'm Maureen Cavanaugh, sitting in for Tom Fudge. You're listening to These Days. When the U.S. was preparing to invade Iraq, President Bush found the mission a hard sell in several European countries. That's because there's history between Europe and the Arab world that some nations may not have been eager to repeat. During the last century, a series of bloody and relentless revolts routed the British and French colonial governments in the region. One of the largest and longest-lasting anti-colonial insurgencies took place in Syria in 1925. Michael Provance is the author of a new book called The Great Syrian Revolt and the Rise of Arab Nationalism. Provance is an assistant professor of history at UCSD and an expert on the history of the Middle East. Michael, welcome to These Days.
Thanks, Maureen. It's nice to be here.
Now, why is it that you trace the rise of Arab nationalism specifically to that revolt in Syria in 1925?
Well, the revolt, and there were other revolts elsewhere in Iraq earlier, in Palestine a little later. All of these revolts had the effect of sort of galvanizing the populations of those countries and giving them the notion that they were a unified community. So the revolts are formative experiences in the national history of all of those countries, well remembered until today and discussed and taught in elementary school classrooms. So the people who took part in these revolts are the national heroes of each of these countries.
Now, when we speak of nationalism in the Arab world, it's often a bit dicey because after the First World War, the League of Nations sort of just redrew the boundaries of the old Ottoman Empire. Is that how these nations came to be?
Well, that's exactly right. With the small exception that the League of Nations sort of validated what the British and French imperial forces wished to do. So in other words, Syria became a French mandate, Lebanon became a French mandate, Iraq and Palestine and Transjordan British. So the League of Nations kind of put the official stamp on it, but the colonial powers of Britain and France actually drew the borders based on their interests and their negotiations with one another and with no regard whatsoever to the wishes of the populations of those countries who, in every case, wished to be independent and not governed by those colonial empires.
And is that how the boundaries of the present-day Iraq were drawn?
That's right. Iraq, Palestine, what was then British Mandatory Palestine, today Israel, Transjordan, or today's Jordan, Lebanon and Syria. Every border in the Middle East, without exception, was drawn during this period. And we can also say that nearly every conflict, probably every conflict from that time until today, has its roots in some form or another in those colonial boundaries and those colonial arrangements.
But the thesis of your book is that despite the fact that these are a sort of gerrymandered boundaries, that there is inside these nations a nationalism grew anyway.
That's true. I mean, there is such a thing as Syrian national identity, Iraqi national identity, strained though it is at the moment, particularly in Iraq. But it was the actual participation in these revolts that served to cement this sense of identity between these disparate peoples, and it's the unification in opposition to foreign occupation that led to this kind of sense of national identity.
Well, how did the anti-colonial rebels unite all these forces against an occupying nation? How did they go about doing that?
Well, not very systematically. I mean, there were a lot of letters and things like that that I used to try to represent what they thought they were doing at the time, and it's, you know, they're quite diverse and dispersed in the way that people talked about things. For some people, they envisioned a non-sectarian, secular, nationalist government. Other people thought that they were fighting for religion. For some people, the nation centered on their village. So there's a wide spectrum of ideas. But everyone could agree that they were fighting, in this case, the French. And that was the one thing about which everyone could find consensus on.
Did this Syrian revolt, was it the first to rely on an Islamic identity?
Well, there was some reliance on an Islamic identity, but not too much. The revolt began in an area that was principally populated by people who were one of the religious minorities of the region, the Druze. And so there was not too much emphasis on Islamic identification, because this would have marginalized these people. So for them, for that group, a secular national identity was more important and was something that they emphasized. But as I say, there was a lot of difference from region to region and even person to person.
So bringing what you're saying into the present day, is what we hear about the political differences between Sunni and Shiites in Iraq, do you think that's exaggerated?
Sometimes, probably. I mean, the sectarian differences in Iraq have certainly been exacerbated by the invasion and what's happened since then. And to some extent, this is a natural byproduct of a kind of a project of occupation by an outside power, by a colonial power, because it's necessary for an outside power to fragment the society to some extent in order to prevent the emergence of a unified national front to that occupation project. This is what the French did. This is what the British did elsewhere as well, in India, for example. So that kind of fragmentation is a kind of a necessary result of an invasion and occupation, and it's happened in Iraq as well.
Now, early in the last century, why is it that the Western powers wanted to occupy these countries? What was their motivation?
Well, there were many things. Oil was, of course, important. The British Navy had converted to fuel oil,
to oil
in 1912, yeah. While Winston Churchill was Lord of the Admiralty. So oil was important. Everyone knew that there was plenty of coal in Europe and no oil. And so oil was important. The British had oil concessions in Persia or Iran. Also in Iraq, Kuwait was important. And so oil was important. The domination of the Persian Gulf was something. Rivalry between the two powers was important. And then this sort of nebulous, not very concrete concept of imperial prestige, the idea that Britain and France had to remain strong, had to not show weakness, had to be resolute in the face of opposition in their colonial empires. Ideas like this, not too different from today, we could say.
What was it that finally convinced the Western powers to get out, to leave, force them to leave, I suppose?
Well, this was a 20-year-long experience, or roughly 20 to 30 years, and it was totally unsuccessful. It was a tragedy for the countries involved. It was a tragedy for the imperial powers. After the Second World War, they were broke. They had been, in some cases, humiliated by the defeats that they had suffered from the Germans in Europe. And the cost of maintaining domination over these peoples, none of whom wished to be dominated, was impossible. And so Britain had already left Iraq, left Transjordan. The French left Syria and Lebanon. And not too much later, the British left Egypt. So it was a matter of the impossible cost of maintaining the domination over these peoples that made it necessary.
And this is the reason that you say President Bush had a hard time convincing European countries to get involved in the idea of invading Iraq because of this history. But it really didn't impact on Britain, did it?
Well, the British situation is a little complicated, I think, with regard to the Iraq War. I mean, this was a policy that Prime Minister Blair sold at great personal cost and against much more opposition than President Bush faced here. And some of this was principled opposition by people who remembered or were aware of the British history in Iraq. But Britain took part anyway. In France, of course, where Algeria is a recent memory and something that's continually debated in public discourse, it was tougher. But I would say that recent British history, like the Suez Canal crisis of the mid-1950s and things like this, were very fresh in the minds of lots of British politicians. I mean, he lost his foreign minister. His foreign minister resigned in protest. It was a very controversial policy in Britain.
To be fair, though, the U.S. occupation of Iraq is not really colonialism in the classic sense. I mean, supporters of the invasion say that we are the first outside power that is helping an Arab nation gain its freedom from a dictatorial regime.
Well, that's absolutely true. However, if we examine the things that the British and the French said about what they were doing in the region, we will find that the echoes are intense and, in fact, exact. And, of course, what's important here and what actually matters is not how we perceive what we're doing, but how those at the receiving end perceive what we're doing. And for the Iraqis and for virtually the entire rest of the world, most particularly the Arab and Islamic world, it is neocolonialism in every respect. And so the antecedent and the referent for the people in Iraq and elsewhere is not, liberation in post-war Europe or something like this, but precisely what was experienced under British rule in the 1920s and 30s. So this is what we have to understand, and this is what we don't understand, that for people in this region, the echoes are intense and everywhere, and they point precisely to this period of colonial rule in the 20s and 30s.
You know, there's a very telling exchange right in the very beginning of your book. There's a European Commission on the Syrian revolt describing the people as backward, hating progress, no desire to better their lives. And then there's an excerpt from a Syrian rebel in a letter to his people saying the reason we have to take up arms is because the colonial powers are strangling freedom of thought and speech, and it's very sophisticated. And so these two sides really don't understand each other at all. Is that the same level of misunderstanding that we're dealing with now in Iraq?
I think so. I mean, the level of misunderstanding is tremendous. We hear a lot about Iraq is a medieval theocracy or something like this. And, of course, this is utter nonsense. It looks very clear that the constitution that Iraq will eventually have will be less secular and probably less progressive than the constitution that Iraq had under the Ba'athist government. Now, we have to qualify that emphatically by saying that the constitution under the Ba'athist government was not honored by the government. But having said that, it did contain guarantees of religious freedom. It was secular. Women's rights were prominent. The rights of minorities were prominent. All of these things existed in the constitution that the country had before the invasion. So these are things that Americans are totally unaware of, for by and large.
Michael Provance, you are headed to Lebanon, and we wish you well there. And thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much. It's my pleasure.
I've been speaking with UCSD Assistant Professor of History Michael Provance. He's written the new book, The Great Syrian Revolt and the Rise of Arab Nationalism.